This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tāne, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Welcome to Community or Chaos, friends. Today we have with us Pete Hodgson, who's a former Member of Parliament in Dunedin North and has been chair of the person of the Southern District Health Board. And we're going to be talking about health and possible privatization of some aspects. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Well, welcome on board, Pete.
Thank you, man. How are you?
Good. Pete, what triggered you to write the article in the ODT, Privatizing Our Health System by Stealth?
Well, I think the government is up to some things that no previous government has been up to. I think they've crossed a line, and it takes a bit of explaining. So is that what I'm to do? Do you want me
yes.
to take you through it?
We've got 50 minutes.
How many?
55.
Okay. Let's go with. Let me just paint a picture that New Zealand has a public health system, which means that it's predominantly but not entirely paid for through taxation. We also pay insurance. We also have ACC levies. We also have out-of-pocket expenses when you and I go and buy some Panadol from the supermarket or whatever it's to be. So a range of funding, but basically it's a public health system. There is also a private health system in New Zealand because of insurance that I've just mentioned. And so the public health system works with the private health system to the benefit of both, or can work with the private health system to the benefit of both. And the essential feature of that working together is that different parts of the system do different things. The private sector looks after insured patients. The public sector does not. The private sector is available or can be available to deal with some sort of overload or some sort of excess requirements that the public sector might have. So from time to time, there's contracting out of bits and pieces from the public sector to the private sector. And that's most common and most noticeable with planned surgery, with, say, hips or indeed with cataracts. And so from time to time, all DHBs, now the National Health System, will contract out to the private sector. And that's helpful for the public sector. It also does give the private sector a bit more revenue. So that's a thing that has happened for years. And the reason I wrote this article that you mentioned, Marvin, is that we've crossed a line. We've moved from the public sector using the private sector for some period of time for short-term contracts just in this area or just in that area, to what seems to be longer-term contracts across the whole country. And in ophthalmology, that means that private sector ophthalmologists will be doing those cataracts that I mentioned, or treating macular degeneration or whatever it is that's going on with the eye, prospectively across all of New Zealand for an extended period of time. Now, if that comes to pass and it's showing signs that it will, then we've shifted the goalposts. We've then got a ophthalmology which is may well be substantially provided for in the private sector or heading towards that. And that then has impacts on, especially on training, because we've got to ask ourselves, where do the ophthalmologists come from? And the really important question is, if the government's got spare money to buy a whole lot of ophthalmology from the private sector, why don't they invest it in ophthalmology in the public sector? And that, frankly, is where the argument stops.
Well, what's wrong with privatizing healthcare? I mean, some economists and so on suggest we should privatize a lot.
Not many economists.
I'm sure if you ask ACT, they would say
they might, but they would be hopelessly, provably wrong. Private sector health is not cheaper. Private sector health is more expensive. And that's why in all countries, all developed countries, with the notable exception of the United States, health is provided by some, but predominantly private, publicly, either through taxation, as the case in New Zealand or, say, Britain, or by social insurance. Only in the United States is it a substantially private
and
business.
Most users in the United States don't actually consider it a success. 30% of people who are insured don't get the health care they're required and that they expect.
That's right.
The insurance providers are quite disliked in America.
Well, of course, because their job, if they're to be successful, is to reduce the services that they provide and increase the premiums that they charge. That's what keeps them afloat. And there are middlemen everywhere. So your 30% fact is a useful measure. Here's another one. New Zealand spends about 8 or 9% of our GDP on health. America's up around 17, and New Zealanders live fractionally longer. So how come they're spending twice their GDP? And it's a much bigger GDP, of course, and yet they're not getting the health outcomes.
What would other European countries spend on healthcare GDP?
The predominant one is social insurance. So that's very similar to taxation. I'll tell you the difference as we go along. But social insurance predominates in all of the major European nations. I can't tell you about all of them, but I do know that Germany and Holland and Austria and France and Italy, maybe I'm not so sure what the situation in Spain is, but all of those countries have a social insurance system. And that means that we all pay, but we all pay according to who we are. And the best way to explain that is to go to the New Zealand ACC system, which is also social insurance. We all pay ACC through our wages, but only motorists pay ACC through their petrol. So it's not as universal as taxation, because different people pay different amounts. People who've got high dangerous occupations have a higher ACC levy and so on. Whereas taxation, in its purest form, everybody pays according to their ability to pay if it's a progressive system, not according to what their occupation is. So slight differences between social insurance and taxation, but but both can be considered public health systems.
Have we been training enough doctors?
No.
I mean, it seems to me that health insurance is really, in New Zealand and in most countries, is really connected to our revenue system, our taxation, or unless you have a insurance system.
So there's two thoughts going there. The one was about doctor training.
The other is about providing the money to train doctors.
Oh.
And also provide hospitals and the other.
Yeah, well, so we train doctors by using taxation. We have a public education system, yeah. And doctors are trained using that. Of course, because they're students, they pay student fees. They contribute to their own education, but it is still most of it, three quarters of it or thereabouts, is paid for by the taxpayer. And then the subsequent training, because as you imagine, you know, doctors are trained at the undergraduate level and then they become trainee interns and they're trained at that level and then they become junior housemen and senior house surgeons and so on. And all of that training is done, nearly all of that training is done in the public system, in public hospitals. And the private sector doesn't much contribute to training. It doesn't contribute anywhere near proportionately. So in that sense, the private system's freeloading.
Don't we actually need, isn't the one of the reasons for providing good hospitals is a lot of the training needs to take place in hospitals?
That's exactly the point that I'm trying to make. And a lot of the training takes place in hospitals. So there used to be a time when there was that terminology which applied to Dunedin Hospital. People would say that it's a teaching hospital. Nearly all hospitals are teaching hospitals these days, although Dunedin and Christchurch and Auckland and Wellington tend to be hospitals that teach at the earlier stages of training, whereas, you know, Invercargill or Whangarei would be inclined to take on people who were graduates or nearly graduates or postgraduates.
Is one of the problems we have with health the lack of trained medical staff?
Yes, there's a shortage of doctors, which is why the government has decided to open the new third medical school at Waikato, and I mean, that's its own story, but the fact of the matter is that we haven't increased the number of doctors proportionate to our increase in population, and it's time we did. And both Auckland and Otago could manage that increase now with virtually no additional investment in buildings, etc. So why the government hasn't used the existing medical schools in the meantime, as well as starting the new little medical school in Waikato, is beyond me. I think it's a story for another time, but there's undue lobbying and undue influence going on in that decision without any doubt, and it involves seniors, people at Waikato University, and government ministers and government ex-ministers. I'm not naming anybody because I want to keep you safe legally, but that's what's been going on with Waikato.
It seems to me that healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, and so on, two factors is the education system itself, and then there's the hospitals.
Yeah, I mean, all health professionals are trained somewhat on the job. You know, all you could call it apprenticeships if you wanted to, but all health professionals, physiotherapists or midwives or whatever it's to be, all learn partly in the classroom and partly on the job, and therefore they have to have access to patients. And although there is some training in the community, including with GP practices and including with other providers like mental health providers, Māori health providers, whatever it's to be, the bulk of training of New Zealand health professionals takes place in New Zealand public hospitals.
How many of them go overseas after finishing training, would you think?
Well, it depends on, are you talking about doctors still?
Yeah.
Right. The answer is 40%.
I was wondering, if we had a revenue system that collected enough revenue and an ideology that education should be free, would we keep more people if...
No. No, doctors, generally speaking, don't go offshore in order to avoid paying fees. They go offshore for a mixture of sort of personal and professional reasons. They might decide they want to live somewhere else for fun, and they've got, you know, a doctor can go wherever the doctor likes because everyone wants doctors. Or they go because they want to explore a specialty in greater depth, and they want to become better at their particular specialty or subspecialty. And so they go for both a mixture of personal and professional reasons. Now, it needs to be just said in the same breath that about 40% of the doctors practicing in New Zealand come from offshore. So we've got the opposite happening. People are coming from other nations, practicing in New Zealand, enjoying the idea of learning their subspecialty here, enjoying the idea of living in New Zealand because they think it's a nice place. It would not be wise to try and constrain either of those things. The best thing we can do is to train doctors in New Zealand who are keen to work here, and the best way to do that is to train more New Zealanders and say to them, you've got a future here in general practice. It isn't underpaid. You've got a future here in this hospital or that hospital. There is going to be work for you, and see if we can't retain more of them by that method.
I suspect from what I've seen of hospitals and so on, there's a sense of obligation to the community.
The people who work in public health systems do so because they, to a greater or lesser extent, support the idea of public health. I saw an interview with a woman who works in Timaru, who came from America. I saw it on the television the other night. Probably half your listeners saw the same thing. She said, I've come to New Zealand because in America, sometimes if I have to treat my patient, I have to bankrupt them, and I don't like it. So she came to New Zealand for that reason. Yeah.
I guess I'm old-fashioned enough to think that if we had free education, that would increase the sense of obligation.
It might, and it might be the case. It might be the case that we can have free education and tie it to some sort of
bonding,
teacher. Yeah. Either a bond to work in New Zealand or a bond to work in rural New Zealand or whatever. And those systems have been tried many, you know, and so let's not say they're a bad thing. They've worked. They work also in education. But they are not in vogue at the moment. It might be that it would be beholden to the National Health Service to say that, you know, to explore that and to say that they would be prepared. The smartest way probably is to bond someone to say we will pay you this amount plus we will pay down your student loan, pay you a salary plus a contribution to your student loan, something of that sort.
Should we consider that we have one of the lower tax systems in in the developed world?
In overall taxation, we're about average. So nations fall into roughly two camps, those where taxation's about, say, 35-38% of GDP, and those where it sits more like 50. And the 50s are you know, Scandinavia and these days France, and I'm trying to think of another. There will be others, but I can't think of them. And most other nations sit at around the, you know, at the 35, 40-ish mark.
We used to be in the 50th, didn't we?
No, not to my knowledge.
Not in the 70s or 60s?
No, certainly not. Certainly not that recently.
But okay.
No, never been.
Should we consider paying higher taxes?
Well, we can change our society. We can have much bigger increases in taxation, which in the case of Scandinavia, well, actually Sweden's walking away from it at the moment. They're going back towards a sort of 35-40. But other, you know, Denmark washes more than 50% of its economy through the state. And in fact, well more. And what they do is that they have pay much more attention to transfer payments. So that's things like, let's call them working for families, accommodation supplement, that idea. Those sorts of transfer payments are huge in Denmark, somewhere heading towards, but nowhere near to, a universal income. The Danish health system is not materially different to New Zealand's. So New Zealand's health system is underfunded without any doubt, but it is not hugely underfunded. It's underfunded by an amount that needs a little increase in health or a little allocation from other sources of expenditure, but not huge.
Does private insurance and public health, are they in some sense in competition?
Well, it depends who you ask. I mean, let me start by putting the contrary view to you. Some well-meaning folk, not including me, I don't have insurance, some well-meaning folk take out insurance in order to spare the public health system, you know. And yet, on the other hand, if you're a doctor, I mean, I don't mean to besmirch people, but you know, if you're the classic orthopedic surgeon, you want the private health sector because you can make a mint, and you also want the public health system because that's where the difficult, interesting, intriguing, professionally challenging cases are. The private health system doesn't do hard stuff. There's no money in it. The private sector finds a way to offload all of that to the public sector. And so that's one reason why doctors, very common, surgeons typically, very commonly work across both the private and public health systems.
I guess people make choices. I certainly know doctors that purposely work in the public system wholly.
Well, I think one of the things that this is an idea which I didn't progress when I was Minister of Health and didn't progress when I was chair of the DHB, and I could have, and I'm going to throw it out now. I think people who work entirely in the public health system should be recognised for that choice. And it could be a pay differential. It could be something like greater expenditure on conference travel. Two conferences a year, not one or something. I just made that up. In other words, that there's a recognition by the system that someone who's committed to the public system in its entirety should be, you know, should should be rewarded somewhat for that. Certainly people who go 50-50 are rewarded in the private sector. That's why they go there. I just think it would be nice to reward public, purely public sector players for that reason.
How are we set for keeping our hospitals up to date?
You mean physically?
Physically, I guess.
Yeah, as an asset?
Yeah.
We're doing badly. Here I speak with some authority because of my role in the Dunedin Public Hospital and the new Dunedin Public Hospital, about which I know quite a bit. But instead of asking for my opinion, why don't we reach for the Infrastructure Commission's opinion, which is that we need to roughly double our expenditure on capital works in hospitals in order to keep them from falling into disrepair and disarray. I would say to you that the Dunedin Public Hospital is an example of poor maintenance and actually even poor design at the outset, because it's very hard to maintain. The spaces in the existing Dunedin Hospital are skinny. It's very hard to get engineers, will tell you that it's very hard to work in a place like that and get things fixed. So it hasn't been well designed, but it hasn't been well maintained either. And as a whole, our assets need better maintenance and need earlier replacement. So we need to double for both maintenance and replacement purposes. We need to double our capital expenditure. So said the Infrastructure Commission.
It's actually, isn't it cheaper for the government to borrow money than for private industry to borrow money?
Yes, the Crown has the cheapest access to capital of any player in the New Zealand economy, or indeed of any economy.
Well, you know you're probably going to get your money back if you borrow from
the The Crown can get its money back because the Crown alone can tax people. Private sector can't go around taxing people if it gets into trouble.
Anyway, if you're asked to, I mean, so it's a win-win in certain situations.
I'm not sure where you're going. What are you saying?
I'm wondering if we should really reconsider the 30-30 rule.
What's that?
That keep the idea that we should reduce the size of government and debt below 30% of GDP. That's actually, I think, part of Treasury's.
Oh, okay. So let me try and explain that to listeners. We were just talking about the size of government, and I said that quite a lot of governments fall into the 35% or even up to 40% of GDP. And now the proposition is that it be reduced to 30. I don't think a modern economy will get by easily on 30. I don't think it'll do the things that the citizens want it to do on 30%. So no, I disagree. It got down to about 33 when I was in cabinet, or 34. It's just the way the numbers tumbled. We didn't particularly try to get it low. But, you know, 30 would be just too tight. As far as debt's concerned, our debt currently sits at about 50. And when Muldoon was around, it got really high, got up over 70, and that's dangerous. And yet we can also get it down to near enough to zero, and have done, including, again, when Michael Cullen was Minister of Finance, we got our debt well down. So 30% debt is achievable, but it needs to be, if you're going to have very low debt, you might have an asset deficit. You might have potholes in your roads. You might have hospitals that are falling down. So you need to weigh what the public debt should be against what the state of the assets are. And in the case, when I say we got the, we managed to get the debt well down, it's because we didn't for 9 years refuse to offer up tax cuts, and therefore we were able to pay down the debt and also get a bit of saving going with Kiwi Bank with KiwiSaver and the Cullen Fund and so on. So that was our government, but New Zealand can't really tolerate a debt much higher than 50. We start to scare the bloody bond markets. We've been much lower than 50, including down to near enough to zero. So 30% debt's not a bad figure. It's just that it needs to be measured against the state of our assets.
Isn't it actually, in a way, more costly to not maintain your assets and then find that you actually have to? All of a sudden, there are many of them going wrong at the same time because you haven't maintained them.
That's right. And then if you add into that two other factors going on in New Zealand, one is earthquake risk, a second is climate change, then we've got some pretty interesting asset challenges in front of us. And so we will have a managed retreat. We will not fix every road. We will close some roads, for example. We are building the new Dunedin Hospital, although it's in a low part of town. We're building it. When it starts going up, people will notice. They can already see it with the outpatients building that it's been raised because of climate change and storm surge, and the risk of that coming up the harbour. So some planning for the future is a future of climate change and earthquakes is now an imperative with all of our asset replacement. And if we don't do that, we're going to just end up in some trouble in the future.
So in some ways, wouldn't it be better to have between 30 and 40% and actually deal with the infrastructure that we need to build or that we need to keep in repair than?
I think going for zero debt's pretty much a dumb idea. It's not. Having a bit of debt on the books is a good thing for the reasons that I think you're alluding to, which is that we're putting money to work to get improvement on this or that asset. I mean,
building capital goods like power and like transportation, healthcare. Well, this is something that's not a waste of money if you do it properly.
No, indeed, it isn't.
It is a waste of money if you just neglect it until you have to do something.
Yeah, so asset management in the health system has been poor. Asset management in our roading is probably a bit better. Asset management of our electricity assets is actually pretty good, because it has to be, because hydro dams you can't take shortcuts with. You know, you can't. They're dangerous structures, so they have to be well built. But you know, in general, New Zealand has got an asset deficit, and it's got a debt, which is 50% of GDP. And so, what we need to have is a stronger economy to enable increased investment in our assets, or to reduce a debt a wee bit, or a bit of both.
How do you get that stronger economy?
Well, the current government is, you know, making a big song and dance about a stronger economy, and as if they are the first to think of it. But now we're off the health system and talking about economic development, yep, which was another portfolio that I used to manage. I would make a couple of points. The first is that the New Zealand economy is changing whether we like it or not. It is more driven by technology, including technology exports, than ever before. That includes agri-technology, it includes biotechnology, it includes all sorts of technology. So if you look at, I mean, just about 200 metres from where we are now, there's education technology and you know, a couple of wonderful businesses in Dunedin that are spin-outs from the University of you know, education technology. So technology's many things, and really a really important thing, given that the Tech Week was only last week, and is to remind us that our technology exports are now very large. Who would have thought that buying software from New Zealand was a thing? Well, it is, and some of those technologies are sort of famous, like, you know, Fisher and Paykel Healthcare, or the new one, Halter, you know, which is a new way of controlling dairy cattle or cattle in general, which are going to be very big companies. But technology is a thing. The second comment I would make, and technology's not hugely supported by this government. They're not down on it, but they are just all about tourism and dairying. And like, That's
fairly narrow, isn't it?
It's not enough. And tourism very often involves low-paid jobs. Dairying involves quite a lot of environmental challenge. Anyway, the second point that I'd make about economic development is that we, long before the bloody Iran war, this country and every other country needs to get off fossil fuels because of climate change. It is bigger than Ben-Hur, is climate change. And New Zealand is very well positioned to do that with wind and solar and geothermal and microhydro and solar power on roofs and electric cars and God knows what. You know, so we are in a position where we can make very significant changes in decarbonising our economy. And under the previous government, in my telling anyway, according to me, there was very considerable progress made. Most of those programs were willfully, determinedly taken down by the current government. They were just ideologically opposed to any support for something that was sort of green or goody-two-shoes or woke or whatever it is, whatever word they like, they used to express their dislike of those technologies, is, you know, they pull these things to bits. And just in the last week, they've started pulling them back together again because New Zealand's running out of gas and because of Iran and blah, blah, they've decided to, you know, reintroduce assistance for companies to help them electrify and decarbonise. And I'm sort of annoyed that as a country we have to go through this nonsense of, you know, the new government knows best until they work out that the old government probably had a few things right after all. It's really tedious.
That's expensive too.
Yes, it is. There's a lot of lost opportunity. And the point I'm making is that, you know, the economic development from renewables is really considerable, and they are now way cheaper than fossil fuels. There's always going to be issues with storage, and that's a useful topic for conversation. You know, I spent time as Minister of Energy, so again, I know a bit of the background. But generally speaking, New Zealand is the lucky country when it comes to energy, way luckier than Australia, for example. They have no mountains, so they have no hydro, so they have no hydro storage, so they can make electricity out of sunshine because they've got plenty of desert, but they're hard put to do anything with it.
If you have solar panels and wind farms, Can you use those and save the hydropower for when you need it?
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed is that since the putting electricity on the market, the people are actually paying a lot more for electricity.
Well,
and it seems to me that sometimes part of the reason they're paid is because of developments that haven't happened. And the other thing that's a problem is that if electricity goes up, you may actually lose certain industries.
Yeah, right. There's a bit in that question.
Yeah.
So, and all of a sudden we're not talking about health, but here we go. And I'm just going to try and make a few simple remarks. And the first is that about electricity prices rising, let's remember that some of that is due to transmission and distribution. So wires, Transpower, our own lines companies, some of that increase is due to that. And that's back to assets. These people do need to manage their assets, and we end up paying for it. These prices are regulated because these people are monopolies, and probably the regulations not too bad. So probably those price increases that we face from our lines companies are fair enough. On the other hand, the generation of electricity has changed in the last 20 years. It used to be that we designed an electricity market on the basis that the next piece of kit to be developed for new generation, the next hydro scheme, the next geothermal scheme, whatever it's to be, would be a little more expensive than the one we just built before, that we've used up all of the cheapest ways of getting electricity. We have to go to the next best thing for additional electricity. And that is no longer the case, because both wind, but especially solar, are now way cheaper than the next hydro scheme, way cheaper than the next geothermal scheme, way cheaper than combined cycle gas turbines and so on. So that the existing electricity companies are at major risk of being competed away by companies that are starting, like Electric Kiwi and those companies that are starting and building solar only or solar plus wind. Those companies can manufacture and sell electricity much more cheaply if only they had a bit of storage to get us through the night time and to get us through the winter. And that storage is all locked up by the big guys. And that's where the idea of having a storage system at Lake Onslow came from. That would be run by the Crown. Or if not, it would be run separate from the market. And it would allow the cheap electricity generators to get underway and give them some support with that storage at a price, of course. But it means that we would end up with a lot more competition in generation. And that's why Onslow, or an idea like Onslow, is so important. This government put a stop to it. And it's only the fact that there are a few pioneering private sector folks still interested in this that we're still looking at it. So electricity really is a significant opportunity for New Zealand. We can produce a lot more of it, and we can produce more of it at no great increase in price or even a reduction in price. So we need to seize that opportunity.
What would you suggest that we do actually keep our health sector, keep modernized. How much building do we need for hospitals? How much do we need to do, and how do we pay for it?
The amount that we need is about twice the amount that we're spending now. So, if I'm to put a figure on it, and please, would listeners please excuse me because this is a really rough figure. It would be something in the order of $2 billion per annum or $2.5 billion per annum every year. That's the amount that we need. The size of the New Zealand economy is about near enough $400 billion a year. So $2.5 billion for hospital capital works versus $400 billion for the size of the economy. This is doable, for goodness sake. If we need to increase taxation a little, fine. If we need to, you know, reverse the changes that gave landlords a big tax break, fine. I'm not going to get into taxation policy here, but we still have an unbalanced approach to tax. We can still tolerate a slight increase in taxation without any major change. You know, we don't have to become Scandinavian to build better hospitals. We can just improve our taxation system a little. That's not hard to do. I think the important thing is to make sure that the expenditure is as efficient as possible, and that existing assets are maintained as well as possible, so that we don't have to build hospitals every 50 years, but every 80 years instead.
Do you think that if there was a real discussion of taxation in relation to hospitals and education, things that people use all the time, that we would, New Zealanders, would be less resistant to tax rises? Of small tax rises?
I think most New Zealanders would tolerate a small increase in taxation if they believed that it was going into health and education, yes.
But that's not really a conversation that's been easy to have. At least we haven't had it.
We've had bits of it. So the current Labour Party policy on one of the reasons that the Labour Party managed to get away with announcing a capital gains tax should they form a government is that they said we could put money into free doctor's visits. Now, you could probably pay for a lot more than three free doctor's visits from a capital gains tax once it bedded in. But it does take a while to bed in, and it might be that three free doctor's visits is not the best use of the money. You know, those are just debates of detail. The point I'm making is that we have had an example of a slight increase in taxation going towards health and education, or in this case towards free doctor's visits, that was accepted. It's a real live example of just that.
Mm. The Labour Party in Australia has just made a big increase in capital gains tax, I understand.
Well, they've changed the criteria near enough, yes. Let's just say yes. It's a little more complicated than that, but it's in that direction. Yep.
And that does two things with it. It increases the revenue for things like education, healthcare, but it also probably increases the ability to improve the housing situation.
Or to make housing affordable. That's right. And that's the logic behind that budget announcement, was to improve the chances of first-time ownership.
Is that a discussion we should be having in New Zealand?
Yeah, it's where the capital gains tax idea came from. So, yes.
So all these things fit together, don't they?
They do a bit. I've got a very coherent view of what the future for New Zealand should look like. It's much broader than health. But, yes, things do fit together. And, you know, if you want to talk about security and defence, because we've decided to go building, you know, some, you know, refitting our frigates, well, that's good. You know, it's probably not a bad use of money. But the biggest security problems that we face are with climate change. With earthquakes, and with pandemics, so you know, having good assets, having good health systems, you know, being decarbonizing our economy, getting away from the effects of wars and you know, people like Russia or Iran or America frigging around with our fuel system. All of these things help the resilience of the New Zealand economy and of our society.
Well, what are your hopes for New Zealand? And you've got about 2 minutes now.
I want to live in a country that embraces the future a bit more aggressively than we are, and by that I mean embraces a future where social change is a good thing, where we place emphasis on tolerance and emphasis on letting people express themselves in their religion or in their politics or whatever it's to be freely. And so that comes to mind early for me. And then the environment. I think that this country can decarbonize pretty solidly, pretty quickly, and should. And that the economic opportunities arising from that are significant. And we're seizing some of them, but not very many. So I, overall, want to have a tolerant, sustainable society, and one that's pretty free, where people are free to do what they want. But we do live in a pretty free society. I want to retain that. That's my view.
Well, thanks a lot for coming along and talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a gallop around the,
yes,
the stables. Yeah, it's been good. Thank you. Thanks, listeners.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Pete Hotchkin on healthcare and economics in general. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Okay. Peter.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.